Mentioned Izard, Rail 18. We were talking about your time in Austria after the end of the war with the 16th DLI. Do you remember when you went to Vienna, or did you go with them to Vienna for the ceremonial guarding duties?
The rifle companies took turns in Vienna. Only one company there at the time. It was the sort of honour guard. And I can remember B Company with Laurie Stringer played an active role. They used to mount guard at the Allied Kommandantur, which was French, Russian, American, and British. And they used to mount guard there. And there was a very large parade ground, and it was customary for the company to go through its paces. And I remember they manned the guardhouse, where the Allied commanders coming in would pass through the guardhouse, and it is a matter of record that Mark Clark, the American, commented on the smartness of the guard mounting that particular day, and he sent down, I think it was 8 cartons of 200 Marlboro cigarettes for the guard. He thought they well turned out. Well mounted. B Company represented the battalion at the celebrations. There was a great march past in Vienna. Everybody and his wife was there. I didn't get there, but Laurie Stringer was there, and he had B Company. And they earned good marks for their performance. I'm not sure whether we have a picture of that today.
So what were your duties, basically, during this period in Austria?
Very little. Nobody was interested much in any more training. Majority of men were going to go on and continue serving, of course. We were getting, because this would be the summer, autumn, and we were getting advice of release groups, and everybody was very interested in this, and wanted to travel, and not sure what the interest will be, when did you come in, or did you come in until then, and oh, you've had it, you know, you're going to be here for years yet. And I still have a copy of the last nominal roll with the battalion, because we were losing, well, it's too early yet, but go back to the release groups. Anyway, in the fullness of time, it became clear that the vast number of people, not only in our battalion, brigade, division, but in the entire army and navy and air force, were going to be in what was known as Group 25. Now, these were people who had been in right at the beginning and were of in a certain age bracket, and this was the largest group. The nearest next group was 26, and they were people who had come in immediately after the declaration of war in Ferdinand and had joined in around 1940, because most of 25, the enormous territorial units there, they were all in June. June 39, never came back from camp. So they were Group 25 and then Group 26. And I would think those two would take up 45% of the 16 DLI between them. Then you had groups right up to 38. Chaps who joined in 1942, 43, 44, but they were still being put up. And they were groups right the way back. So, the summer and autumn passed off very pleasantly. We were being given, we had our second leave at that time, and we went by three-time trucks. I can well remember, we were getting a lot of criticism. We had it in Italy too, from Lady Astor. She had accused the British troops of power in half the Italian nation, I think, been very critical. And so I can remember on the side of my three-time truck as we drove through Austria and about through into the south of Germany, and then we came through the Second Front troops. It was our first contact with them. We had three contacts. We met up the Eighth Army, and then we met up with the Army Corps who had fought their way through France and into Germany, present at the victory. And as they went through their line, as you know, we used to shout out to them, "Get your knees brown," and insulting remarks of that kind. And on the side of our truck, some wag had put in bold white lettering, "Lady Astor's Bambinos," on the side of the wagon. And of course, this didn't mean very much to the chaps whose territory was moving through, but it was amusing. And we were allowed home, I think, for 10 days. I think that's all we had each. So we wanted to get as many people back home as we could. And the wagons going back took the last party that came across. It was a shuttle. Alan Hayes said to me, "Can you get up to South Shields and see my wife?" Because he hadn't seen her since the first leave, which was 2 years earlier. So I went and called on Alan's wife, Sheila Hay. And I gave her messages and letters he'd given me. And then I went to two or three other people's homes. I also went and called on four people who had lost their lives with me. Tom Logan's mother. I called on Lady Balance, George Balance's mother, because they both were killed. But the rest of the time, I was with my mother and with my fiancée. And then we were back into Vilden. I went skiing, I remember, that winter. We donned white clothing. It all seems to me to be rather stupid, but I think that they were worried about the Russians. We had a common border with the Russians. The Russian area of Austria was next to the British area of Austria. And there were a lot of stories of ill treatment by the Russians, of the Austrians. A lot of stories of women being ravaged and so forth. I don't know how true it is, but the stories were there. And we, at one stage, we were issued with these white coats and trousers, and we were taken to ski school. And snowshoes. And we talked cross country on snowshoes. And those of us that were showing the aptitude were given skiing lessons. Well, this went on from October through to January. And I can remember we went to Semmering, the Semmering Pass, which is between where we were in Styria and Vienna. And I had skied before, but quite a few of us were issued with a third-class badge for the ski club in Great Britain. But we enjoyed it, but we used to have to do exercises across country. It's very arduous crossing country on snowshoes, even worse on skis. But that period came to an end, and we had Christmas in Vilden, which was a very happy time. People by this time had accepted us. The mayor told me that they enjoyed our occupation more than the German occupation, which startled me a bit. But the mayor was a very decent fellow. He made me a presentation. I've got it still, it was only a small thing, a piece of cut glass. And he said they were grateful for the way in which the Italian had occupied the area and so forth. And then January, we began to lose people. People in group the 30s began to be posted. A lot went to the 1st Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry. Oh, I forgot that. The 1st Battalion, they were in Italy. They were part of the 4th Indian, Shitehawks, 4th Indian Group, 1st Battalion. Under command of Crackers May, Colonel May, known as Crackers, regular soldier. And my best friend, Tom Reynolds, dead now, who became best man at my wedding, had been my second in command in North Africa, Livingstone and Stanley. His fiancée was sister to Crackers May's wife, Liz. And so he said to me, we got Inkerman Day coming up, it's in November. And the 1st Battalion will be celebrating. He said, how do you feel about driving down? I said, don't be daft. They're at Celsa Maggiore, which is, well, it's not very far from Bologna. It became famous later on as the centre of natural gas. Anyway, Celsa Maggiore, that's where the 1st Battalion went. I said to him, it's 500 miles. Well, he said, we'll see what the Colonel says, make it an official. Because we never met up with the 1st Battalion, although they were in Italy. We were different fronts and so forth. And the Colonel said, yes, he said, I won't come because I'm a Dorset man. He said, there's no interest to me. But Bert Newman, Tom Reynolds, and I, and a driver, we went 500 miles, it was, each way. And we arrived in Celsa Maggiore. The 1st Battalion couldn't have been more welcoming. We had a splendid Inkerman dinner, after which we played the traditional regimental game, British Bulldog.
How did you play that? What are the rules of that?
Well, they're very simple. One lot stands on one against one wall of the room, and the other lot stand against the wall of the other. The other wall of the room, and you rush towards each other, and the idea is that this lot have to get to that wall, and this lot have to go that wall, and you literally tear each other's arms and legs off. It's been going on for a couple of hundred years in the British Bulldog. Anyway, we did all that, and we emerged with broken, not broken, strained limbs. Next morning, we drove back. It was quite an increment. And Crackers remembered it because I saw him afterwards. And Tom married his Ursula, and Ursula was sister to Liz. Liz was wife to Crackers. It was all very much a family affair. But men were being posted away all the time, and a lot went to the 1st Battalion. But many others were posted to regiments in the shrinking 46th Division. Others were posted out of the division altogether. Majority were posted to light infantry regiments, King Shropshire's, Duke of Cornwall's, Ireland, and Yorkshire, and so forth. Most of them were posted to light infantry regiments, but the whole operation then began to shrink. Billets were given up. Bill moved into the Stanley's billet, and that house became free. And of course, the local people were very pleased to see that. And we put on a fine Christmas show for the villagers, a performance, a sort of pantomime. And we had a number of performers. We had our little septet. I think we'd augmented it by then. I'm not so sure it didn't become a small orchestra. We certainly had violins, because here he was very hot on their violin. We had two violinists, and we also had some rather good musicians in the working group, the Arbeiten group, and we invited them to come in, it being Christmas. And the village came, and the hall would hold about city, and the villagers came in and they sat down and we put on this performance. I can remember I arranged the last item that one of the German prisoners of war, who was a good violinist, would play for them solo Vienna, City of My Dreams. And they were all weeping. All these Austrians were weeping, you know, in the realization of the Anschluss and of the arrival of the German troops and so forth, and the occupation of Austria, all that had happened ever since. And here they were now in the grip of another foreign group of people, albeit humanitarian and all the rest of it, but nonetheless occupied, likely to remain occupied for a long time. And I think here in Vienna City, the shrinking process continued. We were losing offices, quite a lot of them, because many of the younger ones were in higher release groups, 29, 30, and that sort of thing. And they were going away to different units. It was almost a question of 1,500 way trucks moving off, people shaking hands, exchanging home addresses, waving each other goodbye, and all that kind of thing. Have you got your UXPDR, unexpired portion of the day's rations? It usually used to consist of cheese and bully beef sandwich or something. And that was a constant thing. It was very sad, actually. Very sad time. It broke up in the disbandment. The colonel went, because he went back to the usual. He was due for discharge. The colonel was a farmer, Dorset farmer. And his release group came up. He was, I'm sure he wasn't 24, he was older than I was. They released the older ones first. But Morrill was only, well, I was released at 27, and he would have been 30, I think, not more than that. And so I was senior major, so I oversaw the second in command was a regular soldier, and he'd gone early still. There wasn't a lot left. There was Harry Mine here. He had support company, such as remained of it. We began to close in, and people who were living in schlosses, they take these great castles, you know, spires and so on. And Harry became the Baron Mine here, because he lived in the schloss. I brought them in and grouped them all around Bildern, and there was plenty of accommodation and for the shrinking numbers. And this was a situation through January, releasing them all the time. Messages from brigade headquarters, how are you getting on, you know, how many did you release yesterday, what is your present number of ration strength. And quartermaster was still there. And the RSM, his time came, he left. And it was, the sergeants had got a sort of mess going. And I can remember going there in the evenings and shaking hands with these chaps that we'd soldiered with for 3.5 years. And we all agreed that we would set up an old comrades association after the war. And that indeed is what happened. But in the end, I was the only officer left. They'd all gone. And we had the ordinary room and the ordinary room staff. The prisoners of war had returned to prison of war camps. And they were very sorry to leave. They said that they'd probably had with us the best time that they were going to have as POWs, as they suspected that. After all, they'd lived in huts, a small group of 40, a community, and they were going to go into a great camp where there would be thousands of people. So they left, and I kept up a correspondence with the chap in Schleswig-Holstein for some years afterwards. But then my turn came, and I gathered together the remaining, there were 16 of us, I think, in the end, for us. I gathered up all the loose paper in the orderly room and stuffed it into bags and turned out the lights and locked the door, sent the last radio message to the brigade that it had finally come to an end. And it was the 16th of February at 10:30 in the morning. So we then made our way and we came back through the north of France, through France, somewhat quieter this time. No rude words on the side of the vans, but once they, people had got over the sadness of saying goodbye to their tested and tried friends and colleagues, they quickly picked up their spirits at the thought of being demobilized. And we arrived back in the UK, and I was sent to Woking for a month. And I can still remember going in there with one or two other fellows who were also in the area. And we went to had our papers, you know, and we were all signed up. The man said to me, I remember, "Are you applying for a pension?" So I looked at him and he said, "You're Category B." Because they'd never changed it. So I said, "No, it's because it's a free." So he said, "Well, I've got the documents here." So I said, "That's fine. I've no application." So that was that. When we passed along to the clothing store, I can still remember the fellow, two or three fellows, big counter and racks behind the shirts, pants, vests, coats, jewelry hats and so on. I can still remember this very experienced guy looking at me and saying, "Portly Bert." I was about 14 stone. We'd been eating well, you know. And he said, "Portly." So they gave me this grey suit and shirt, pants and vests and socks and shoes and an overcoat and a jewelry hat. And out we came. I hadn't been home long. I went back to Dorset to see a girl. And we got together and with Alan Hay and Ronnie Shermore. And I had the nominal roles. And we created the first edition of the 16 DOI address book, which was sent to everyone. And there was a second edition of the address book. And it contained a note from me from Colonel Wall saying how proud he had been of us and so forth and all this, because we'd never really had a proper farewell parade. You see, it was a sort of hemorrhage, and he said how proud he had been in command and all that. And I think quite a few of us wished we could return the compliment, because although he was a very courageous fellow and a very cheerful, bright, jolly, hail fellow well met. He wasn't a tactician, but Preston, Colonel Preston. Although he did very well, I suppose. I lost 73 men in those 3.5 years. 73 men killed. And my first job was to go around and call on the wives, mothers, of those 73, so many as I could track. I'd already called on one or two on my leave, but I managed to track down 58 and call on them. The remaining 15, I could never locate. I suppose they'd moved around, but I called on them and I explained the circumstances to them, and of course it had been some time before. They'd got over the initial shocks, but there was a lot of sadness, and I suppose going over the ground again and explaining how it happened. And where the Imperial War Graves Commission were going to set up, because of course there was a tremendous amount of exhuming and then reinterring.
Would you tell them the truth?
Oh, yes.
Or would you make it less painful?
Except I never told them of any agonizing end. I always said it was clean. Yeah, I told them the truth, yes. I mean, even when it wasn't very creditable, I told them the truth. There was one occasion when a chap of mine who was killed had been abandoned by his colleagues. And it's no good hiding the fact. So I got to 58 of them, and the other 15 I gave up on. And all the companies did the same thing. Cherwell called on his, and I think, because Norrie Stringer joined the Gothic line, or shortly before. And this is one of the reasons why Norrie is an excellent chap to talk to, because he came in fresh. And being the He's a territorial decoration. He was in the territorials for a long time. He was a scout commissioner. He has an OBE. He's a fellow with a great interest in life. And he arrived, and it was all new to him. He couldn't understand what they were talking about. He had the same trouble, you see. And he didn't get this running in period we all had. And I remember him saying to me, how do you get on? Because I can't understand them. So I said, well, just you sound made of, you know, he said, oh, yes, he said, I understand you. Come from the beds and heart. But he came fresh. He came tremendous interest in it all. And he was not wearied in the same way. So you'll get the best of it.
Did you go back to your job as an auditor?
No. My grandmother had, at one stage, been accommodating for a nephew of hers, a man called Lee Jones. And he offered me a job in Shell. Well, you see, the market, there were hundreds of thousands of men in 1946. Looking for work, because release groups 25 and 26 were all out, and it was terribly hard to get work. And I was pleased, and he offered me a job. I mean, I would have taken almost anything. No, my job as an auditor had been shut off, and they'd given up having auditors. They'd gone to Price Waterhouse or something. They were providing services, so I took this job in Shell, and I was glad to have it. And I was only out of work. I came out in April. Yes, it was April. I actually got back to the UK. February was the, I don't know what happened in March, I can't remember. Anyway, my official date was April. And my pay, I got a gratuity. It wasn't very much. It's another thing, you see. As a major, I was on 43 shillings a day. Didn't sound much. 1946, and it came to, I think, £800 a year, and all found, only had to pay a mess bill. You were well off, £800, I mean, 43 shillings a day, good pay. Now, when I went to interview in Shell, and I was glad to accept anything, I was offered a job at £450 a year. And support yourself, buy your own clothes, buy your own food, give something to your mother while you're living at home still. And there was a tremendous drop in living standard when I came out of the army.
Did you ever consider trying to stay in the army?
They asked me to, but no, it wasn't for me.
Why not?
Well, I don't think I would have enjoyed the army in peacetime. The interesting part of the army was the wartime. And I know it would have been very nice, and it would be a social life. I would have had overseas tours and so forth, and there would have been some activity of a warlike nature. My mind got caught up in Korea or something, but no, it wasn't really for me. And I, after all, I'd done 3 years as a territorial, I'd done almost 7 in India. That was enough.
Had the army changed you in any way, mentally or physically, would you say?
Well, I'd been to boarding school, you see, in the age of 7 to whatever it was, the Royal British Orphanage. And I'd become a very independent sort of person. I don't think that the army just does that to you. It given me self-confidence. I don't know that I've lacked it, but it gave me self-confidence, yes.